Look, there's a lot of good for the guards. They should stop more parties coming in. Here's two interesting ones, though, from Patrick in Cork. The college ID is the property of the college, not the student. This is the basis for confiscation. As owner of student accommodation, I fully support this practice. It's finally dampening down some outrageous student behaviour. So that's somebody who owns the accommodation, who clearly feels he can't control it. And then there's Nigel, right? Nigel is over 70. He says young people's lives have been destroyed by this older generation. We've made rental properties exorbitant, houses out of reach price-wise. We're destroying the environment for future generations, wiping out wildlife, causing pandemics, destroying jobs. They cannot enjoy universities. They're all locked down. What else are we going to visit on young people? Give them a break. How can we help them to enjoy life? I know all the counter-arguments. That's from Nigel, over 70. Now, I think that in a funny way, Donald Trump being hospitalised with the coronavirus like this has kind of put the frighteners on a lot of people in ways. So let's talk now about how we might COVID-proof ourselves a little bit. And Professor Niall Moynagh from the School of Health and Human Performance in DCU, good afternoon, you're very welcome. Before we get on to COVID-proofing ourselves, Niall, there's a lot of kind of, I think, faux concern around people expressing it for Donald Trump, saying, well, of course, you know, he is obese and he is over 70. And now we know the medications he's on and everything else. And people are saying, oh, wouldn't it be terrible if he got really sick? And oh, what would happen if he died and all this? But there's no doubt he's pretty vulnerable category here, is he?
He meets many of the criteria for increased risk. First of all, he's over 70. He's a male. But we also know from the records that have been published that he is borderline hypertensive. I would suggest he probably has high blood pressure, but they say it's borderline. He's certainly overweight or obese, and he's also on cholesterol medications. And all of that would suggest to me that he has poor metabolic health, and that is the one risk. Metabolic health. And if you have poor metabolic health, you're overweight, you have diabetes, you have heart disease, this virus, it just attacks you.
Okay, can I ask you a question that I have not been able to find the answer to, and I know a lot of men my age are asking it. If you have hypertension, but you are treating it with medication, are you still in the risk category then?
No.
Then you're not regarded as hypertensive for the purposes.
If your blood pressure's in the
normal
range. You know
what, I know that seems like a ridiculous thing, but I'm telling you, that would be a big sigh of relief around a lot of people, I think. So listen, you were in before and you mentioned something about the intermittent fasting, and I wasn't here on that occasion, but you were doing this intermittent fasting, and it is about COVID-proofing yourself. Tell us first about this intermittent fasting and restrictive eating and that kind of thing.
Yeah, well, I actually don't use the term fasting. It's time-restricted eating. And I purposely did it because, you know, we left DCU in March. We had to go home. And I realised within 2 months, even though I was doing my regular exercise, I was obviously consuming more calories because I was putting on weight. And I realised very quickly from the data that was coming out that metabolic health was probably the biggest risk factor for getting severe symptoms or even dying from COVID. So I read the literature and I thought, insulin in particular, when insulin is in your body, so during the day, if we can keep our insulin levels low, because that's what really causes metabolic dysregulation.
Okay, so you want to avoid sugar spikes, essentially, is it?
And we live in a grazing culture. We never stop eating. So basically, we have this glucose surge throughout the day, you know, we consistently high levels of insulin. And I decided that I was going to only eat for one third of the day. So from 1 o'clock to nine, normally from 1 o'clock to 7 p.m. actually, that's when I did my eating. And it has made an enormous difference to me. I haven't...
In what sense?
I feel better. I've lost around 14 pounds. Now, I do a lot of exercise as well, but I probably did the same amount of exercise beforehand. And I think what has happened is over the course of a day, I have probably reduced my caloric consumption by 100 calories a day. Now, people at home are listening saying 100 calories, give me a break. But 100 calories over a month, 2-3 months, that ends up being 10,000 calories. And that's a lot of calories. And all of a sudden, the weight has just gradually started to fall off me over the last, particularly the last 2 months.
Okay. Now, I'm conscious that we don't want to be recommending kind of fatty eating to people. And, you know, we were talking to Amanda earlier, but this is not some kind of fad weight loss diet. Like, you're talking about this as a lifestyle thing in order to make you healthier. Yeah.
Well, I want to make it very clear. I didn't go on a diet.
Yeah.
I don't believe in diets. In fact, there are millions of diets. Every diet works in the short term. There isn't a single diet on earth that we know works long term, because you have to change your behaviour. So I did this. It was nothing got to do with my weight. It was about metabolic health. I made a conscious decision that I wanted to have the insulin levels in my body at a very low level for most of my waking hours.
Now, I'd say people are wondering, is it sustainable, in the sense that I'm kind of half doing it myself at the moment. Now, I'll be upfront about that. That's not why you're here. But basically, I'd say people are thinking, firstly, how do you get to 1 o'clock without eating anything? And then I'd say they want to know, what do you eat between that 1 to 8 window? I think some people use this as an opportunity to go for it. They take it as a challenge, the 8 hours, that I need to eat as much as possible. What's your regime?
I'd say I might fall into that category. I mean, I'm normal. I'm a human being. Like, I've gone for a 3-hour cycle this morning at 7 o'clock. It's now 12:10. I haven't eaten and I haven't even thought of food.
Okay.
Haven't even thought of it. Now, when the urge comes, it's the same with drinking water. When I see people walking around, and they walk around with bottles of water, the Kenyans, which are phenomenal athletes, they drink when they're thirsty. Evolution gives us this tremendous mechanism of thirst. So when we're thirsty, we crave drinks. We shouldn't be. And it's the same with their food. We have all of these fads. So yes, for me, it was a conscious decision, and I have found it. You know, I would probably say after I come back from my morning exercise for 20 minutes, I get that, oh, I better go and have breakfast. And then once I go up and start to work, I forget about it. So I think it's a trained behaviour.
Yeah, and it's probably difficult at the beginning, and then it's like everything. I know, have you ever read that book by Charles Duhigg, The Power of Habit?
No.
And it's a great book, but it's extraordinary how these things, very difficult at the beginning because you're having to make conscious effort to do them. But once it becomes a habit and your unconscious kicks in, it's so much more powerful, like, and it just drives you along. Now, I suppose people would say, though, we've been told for years now that breakfast is the most important meal of the day.
And that's true. Yeah. And in fact, we are probably most metabolically active in the morning. So if you want to burn calories, the morning is to do it, you know. And I'm not saying don't eat breakfast. I actually, when I do eat my first meal at 1 o'clock, it's my breakfast. Because breakfast is called breaking the fast.
And what do you eat then?
I would eat a cereal with strawberries and banana. I'd take a probiotic. That would be it, with a green coffee after it.
And when do you eat again?
In the afternoon. No, I'm into my eating stage now. So I could take a cup of tea and a biscuit at 4 o'clock. You know, I'm a human being. And by the way, I've said this on air before, I'm a chocoholic. And, I could down 10 Mars bars and it wouldn't give me a second thought. But, because of the risk of this, and I'm over 60, I'm 60, almost 62, I'm very, very aware. And I know from my own research, I'm seeing incidences of poor metabolic health in kids who are prepubescent in this country. Right. So, this COVID is a reality. It's a wake-up call for humanity. We just can't medicalize ourselves out of all of these lifestyle diseases. We just can't give people more and more and more drugs. I mean, the average diabetic patient in this country is probably on between 8 and 12 medications. And eventually, if they don't maintain their eating and their drug regime, many of them will end up with kidney failure.
So what's the alternative?
The alternative is, for me, the bottom line for metabolic health and fitness and obesity is primary prevention. The problem we have, I believe, in Western society, and particularly in Ireland, we have a disease care model of health. So get sick, access the healthcare system. And I think we need to totally change that bend to a healthcare model of healthcare. We're very good at disease management. We're not very good at disease prevention. And the problem is, if we think we have a problem now, the current generation of children, they're going to manifest with these lifestyle diseases probably 20 to 30 years prior to when their parents or their grandparents.
So we hear this thing now, excuse me, called social prescribing. Is this what you're talking about? Yeah.
Well, and oddly enough, studies are beginning to emerge now showing that that is probably one of the best ways to get children to change their behaviour. Adolescents.
So to explain what it is, this is a doctor actually giving out lifestyle advice.
Yeah. Yeah, and I'm not too sure even, I mean, physicians are not trained. Physicians, that their average consult with the patient probably is 7 minutes. You cannot expect a medical doctor to look at lifestyle and go through all of these other issues. The doctor will probably say you need to lose weight, you need to change your diet and exercise. We need someone who has expertise in lifestyle medicine, understands behavioural change and psychology, understands nutrition, smoking cessation, exercise, and looks at the whole picture. And the consultant or the MD can then send the individual to this person who then sends them to the local gym. There's that middle person is missing because the physicians are not trained to do this and you can't expect them to do it.
Okay. Now, what people are asking about here is metabolic health. Could you explain, could Niall explain more how to improve your metabolic health?
Well, let me first explain. There's something called the metabolic syndrome. So the metabolic syndrome is if you have 3 of 5 risk factors. Now, hopefully I remember them. One is high blood pressure, high waist circumference, high levels of bad cholesterol and low levels of good cholesterol, and high levels of circulating insulin in your body. If you have 3 of those 5 risk factors, you have what's called the metabolic syndrome, which means that you have high levels of insulin, and that results in this chronic low-grade inflammation that continues 24/7. And this damages your heart, your blood vessels, and many of your organ systems.
And we're hearing a lot about inflammation with COVID, but inflammation is becoming more and more of a thing, isn't it? Like that they think now possibly connections with depression and connections with all kinds of things.
Well, we've known that. Also with many of the brain diseases, with Alzheimer's and some of the other neurodegenerative diseases. This is not nothing new. And for 90% of the people, it's lifestyle mediated. It's choices they're making in their life.
So give us a few, obviously we've got the time-restricted eating. Give us a few other choices people could make because people definitely want to know how to improve their metabolic health. That's clear.
Well, I'll give you another simple example. If you go out for a brisk 40-minute walk, you improve your insulin sensitivity. That means if I eat a carbohydrate meal, I need less to release less insulin to remove those carbohydrates from my bloodstream. You improve your insulin sensitivity. And that happens with a single bout of exercise. If I go for a single bout of exercise and I'm borderline hypertensive, it brings my blood pressure into the normal range for up to 18 hours. And why we're not prescribing these? So exercise, obviously, for me, if we could package the known benefits of exercise in a pill, it would be the most prescribed drug on the planet. The problem is we're trying to always change behaviour. We've got to totally take a radical shift and start adopt, because it's easy to adopt a behaviour in the first place and to change it later on. Because that's why diets don't work. As you said yourself, you're trying to get people to sustain a behavioural change that is so difficult.
Yeah, and we don't have enough willpower anyway.
Of course,
we don't. We have a limited amount of willpower.
And actually the study shows that our brain, once we lose a certain amount of weight, our brain just drives us to eat more calories because it thinks, because evolution says, oh, this guy's not, he's not taking in enough calories. He must be starving. Therefore, and his metabolism decreases and his drive to eat more calories increases as well.
Yeah. And in your brain, if you're on a diet, you're obsessing about food all the time. You're obsessing. Okay, listen, people want practical stuff here, right? What does Dr. Niall eat for dinner? Does he eat fish and sports and veg, simple food and fluids? If so, how much, consistency, etc.?
Yeah, you know, I wish I could sit here. I'm not a nutritionist or a dietitian, so.
Yeah, and look, people, anyone thinking of a radical change like getting into time-restricted eating should check with their doctor first. That goes without saying. But just your advice, like, do you avoid carbs or do you have a proper dinner in the evening?
And it's funny, we talked about time-restricted eating. I'll come back to your question in a moment, but the time-restricted eating, there was a paper published this week in San Francisco where they put a group on time-restricted eating.
Yes, and it didn't work.
Yes, it didn't work. But what's amazing about that was if you look at the individual results, some people lost a lot of weight. So one group maintained three meals a day. The other group went on time-restricted eating. There was no difference in weight loss or no difference in metabolic health. But when you look at the data, and there was another study published last year that compared high-fat to high-carb diet, and the exact same results, you could superimpose them. Some people lose a lot of weight, moderate weight, no weight, and some people actually put on weight. So we all respond differently. Okay. You have to pick the diet that suits you, as long as you're meeting the recommended daily allowance of macro and micronutrients. Pick the diet that suits you. There is no one diet that every
single
person...
Let's not call it a diet. Pick the regime or the habits that suits you.
Yeah, the lifestyle. So on an average day, on a scale of 1 to 10, I would rank myself as a 7. I'm no, you know, I'm not your, I got to eat this and I got to eat that. You know, if someone put up two Mars bars in front of me or a Milky Way, you know, I there was a colleague of mine, she used to take out one slice of a bar of chocolate and eat it and put the bar of chocolate away. I mean, that's just not normal for me. You don't do things like that. But I eat a normal meal in the evening. And I've now what I've done also, I've stopped eating after 7 o'clock. And I, as you said, the last day I was on the show, I can guarantee 99.999% of listeners will not die if they don't eat between 7 o'clock at night and 9 o'clock the
but
next morning.
But a funny thing happens at 7 o'clock when you sit down in your batty in front of the television. You could just keep going like every kind of junk like. But yeah, if you... And again, I would say I'm desperate for that. But if you do just stop it, for it does get easier, like because it's impossible at the beginning.
But think for a moment, Brendan. Yeah. Say it's 200, 300 calories. Over the course, you know, of a week, that's 2,100 calories. It's amazing. Imagine not
you're very innocent. I'd say most people are taking in a lot more than 200 or 300 calories in sitting down in the evening when they hit the junk. People are asking about green coffee. What is it? Where do you get it? And should we be drinking it?
Well, the reason, as I got older, my blood pressure started to increase as well. And I did not want to go on pharmacotherapy. I just, you know, I may have to eventually, but my choice was, you know, if I can take something that's going to keep my blood pressure. And after doing a lot of research, I found that unroasted green coffee contains a chemical called chlorogenic acid, and numerous studies have shown that chlorogenic acid is very effective at lowering blood pressure. So since I've started taking the green coffee, my blood pressure has now gone back into the normal range. Now, I don't know whether that's due to the fact that I've lost weight and I'm also exercising a lot, but the green coffee has certainly made a big difference. Unroasted green coffee.
No, and like that's the thing we should say. You do exercise a lot.
A lot.
I mean, who's going for a 3-hour cycle on a?
I would cycle 90 minutes every morning.
Really?
Yeah.
So you're having an hour and a half of intense exercise every morning.
Well, I wish you're calling it intense. I'm on my bike anyway.
For most of us, it's got to be intense.
Yeah.
Because, you know, we hear that like, oh, if you go for a walk for half an hour every day for the week, that's your exercise for the week. Do we need to be doing a bit more than that?
No. If everyone did that in this country, we would reduce our healthcare budget, I would say conservatively, by 8 to 10 billion. Because a lot of the lifestyle-mediated diseases that we're spending most of our healthcare budget would be eradicated. So if everyone in this country did 30 minutes of brisk walking a day, I'd be very happy.
Okay. But if the more you do, I'm going to get serious. The more you do. The other thing that I hear a lot, and this is again, I suppose, being a man of a certain age and everything, that you have to get into a bit of resistance training. Like it's not just about cardiac. You have to keep muscle is basically disintegrating all the time, yeah, and you have to keep building it. Yeah,
very important point. The problem is when we talk about fitness, most people think it's something got to do with sport. So there's sport related fitness and there's health related fitness. So health related fitness is comprised of cardiovascular fitness, ideal body weight, good balance, and the fourth one is muscular strength and endurance. And unfortunately for all of us, after the age of 30, we're genetically programmed to lose muscle mass. Now, we can reduce the rate at which we lose that muscle by initiating some form of resistance training.
Does that have to be weights and stuff?
Ideally, but it can be body weights rather than lifting weights. Ideally, it's lifting weights, but even just standing there, just doing squats, you know, if you're standing at home at the sink. And very importantly, most women will switch on when I mention resistance training. Remember, most women will not accrue the same amount of muscle as men at the age of 30 because they don't have the same level of testosterone. So they start to lose the muscle from a much lower level. And that's the reason they reach frailty much earlier than men. And no woman has to reach frailty or man if they can sustain and maintain their muscle mass through maybe 2 or 3 times a week, maybe 10 minutes a day. That's all that would be required.
You've stopped going to the gym, yes?
Yeah.
How come?
I just made a conscious decision that I didn't want to put myself in an environment if I didn't have to be there. And I'm very lucky, to be fair. When I'm given advice, I always say if your gym was clean before COVID, go to it. If it wasn't clean before COVID, don't go now. But the DCU gym is spotless. But why would I put myself under that risk? I do a lot of body weights and I have 2 sets of dumbbells at home and that's it.
Yeah. Listen, in terms of that all that exercise and everything, the people, the over 70s who were told to cocoon and all that, like, this has taken a huge toll in terms of all that, in terms of the daily walk and like the keeping moving and stuff, hasn't it?
It certainly has. And that's a worrying issue for me because, you know, the pandemic is going to end. And then people are going to have to get on with their lives. My concern is people in their 70s, 80s and their 90s are sitting at home and they're just losing muscle.
And they're aging.
Aging. They're losing. And activities that will that were very, very easy prior to the pandemic will become much more difficult. And I mean simple activities of daily living, going to the bathroom, walking up a flight of stairs, tying your shoelaces. So it's important that during the day you're getting up. I mean, ideally you should be getting up 3 times an hour for 2 minutes.
Okay.
That's and what
keep,
I would recommend.
So keep moving. Yeah. Keep and, moving and is the trick.
Studies show
to those
that will give you a benefit. Maybe if, you know, a few simple exercises as well, resistance exercises.
So this texter here says, this man is not enjoying life. He is just existing. You don't look like somebody who's, you look like you're all right.
I would say, you know, as I said, I'm 7 on a diet. And because I have my exercise done by 9 o'clock in the morning, I have the rest of the day. I make a conscious decision to get out of bed. And there's nothing like cycling around North Dublin at 7 o'clock in the morning around, you know, the farmlands of North. It's just absolutely beautiful. When everyone else is sitting in traffic, it's a win-win.
Yeah, you're feeling alive. Listen, before you go, DCU is starting back on Monday.
On Monday.
Is that right?
Yeah,
What's that going to be like?
It's been very difficult. I mean, I have to put my hats up to the administration there. They've just done a phenomenal job. My research has been hit very, very badly because I do a lot of research with exercise and people with clinical conditions. And because they're at risk, my research, I've had 9 PhD students, their research totally stopped in March. All the other research is back up again, but I hope we can find ways, you know, to continue. I have cancer patients, you know, people with pulmonary hypertension. It's so important that we also continue to do our research with those individuals.
Okay. Listen, there's so many, people have a lot of questions for you. Like, and we had stuff we wanted to talk about. I didn't get all the questions. Would you come back in a few weeks? Maybe we'll tweet out when you're going to be in and we'll get some questions together because people seem to have got a lot about that.